Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Last time, we explored Chevron, the doctrine that set up an explicit two-part test that ruled administrative law for 40 years. Today, we're going back further to what, as we'll see next episode, is the only thing left standing, and that's Skidmore. To try and put this in perspective, let's think about two different patients. They're sitting in the same doctor's office. First, we have Chevelle.
Okay.
So Chevelle's been having headaches. The doctor does a complete exam. He checks her sinuses, her blood pressure, her sleep patterns, allergies, medication interactions, the whole deal. After all that, he says, take Zyvil twice a day for a week. This looks like allergy-related headaches. They should go away if we can clear up that congestion.
So thorough evaluation, clear recommendation.
And Chevelle thinks, sure, that makes sense. Picks up Zyvil and goes home.
Okay. She's sensible.
And then we have Skye. So Skye walks out of the same office after the exact same meeting, same examination, same issue, and says, you know what? I'd really like a second opinion. So she pulls out her phone, opens ChatGPT, and says, what should I do for headaches? ChatGPT replies, headaches frequently arise from subtle shifts in your body's mineral equilibrium, little electrolyte imbalances that accumulate through stress, green exposure, and irregular hydration. A simple reset is to take 300 milligrams of magnesium glycinate, then drink a full glass of water with a pinch of mineral-rich sea salt. This combination supports neuromuscular relaxation, stabilizes cellular hydration, and helps your nervous system downshift out of the tension cycle that often produces headache symptoms.
Okay, I think I see where we're heading.
Skye thinks, wow, this makes so much more sense than what the doctor was saying. I knew it was something deeper than allergies. Sea salt water. That sounds so natural, so holistic. Why didn't the doctor mention this? Probably because doctors just don't think about the whole body.
Now, we know that it's a particular source of water that makes you healthier.
Clearly, Skye knows that too.
She's going with whichever sounds better to her.
Yeah, she's considering them both and going with what sounds more authoritative. And the problem and the reason why we're using this hypothetical situation is that ChatGPT sounds like that regardless of its veracity. Confident, like it's reading from the Book of All Knowledge, even when it is completely wrong. Every doctor in the country has patients coming in saying stuff like, ChatGPT says I have a brain tumor because my eyelid twitched. It's like Googling symptoms, which was a problem for a really long time, if you could also repeatedly ask Google if it was right and it could reassure you that it is 100% confident in what it's telling you.
And we lawyers have the equivalent. Lawyers asking whether a made-up case is real, and ChatGPT says, yes, absolutely 100% yes, and people trust that enough to turn it into a court.
Yes, and at that point, they get sanctioned for using fake cases. ChatGPT and other AIs, we're just picking on one here, is great at generating stuff that sounds right. It's not great at reliably diagnosing medical conditions, particularly when people had just put in the symptoms themselves and we haven't had a lot of back and forth to try and clarify stuff. It's also really bad at verifying legal precedent. Two fields where sounds right is not enough.
But Skye sees that confident tone in its reasoning and thinks, wow, this must be the correct answer. Even though the doctor's recommendation is based on an actual physical exam of her and his own medical reasoning.
Yes, Chevelle is deferring to the trained expert who examined her. Skye is following the chatbot because the advice sounds better to her.
So Chevelle is Chevron.
Yes, and under Chevron, if Congress writes something ambiguous and the agency, the doctor here, does an analysis based on its expertise, courts defer to that interpretation.
Because the agency is the expert in that case.
Yes, agencies are applying decades of institutional expertise. They're like Chevelle's doctor.
And Skye is Skidmore.
Yep. Under Skidmore, the court doesn't give any deference. It doesn't have to. Agencies under Skidmore get respect only to the extent that their reasoning is persuasive.
So like Skye, reading both answers and saying, I'll go with whichever one I like better.
Yes. This is kind of a convincingness test. The agency has to earn deference. It won't receive it automatically. It has to persuade the court that its reading is the correct reading.
But that also opens a door to Skye's mistake, giving equal or greater weight to an answer that just sounds confident or like what she wanted to hear, even if it's uninformed.
So in theory, Skidmore lets courts pick the better reasoning. In practice, courts pick the explanation that often sounds more appealing. This is like Skye's ChatGPT answer. Instead of going with the expert's detailed but complex reasoning that she doesn't totally understand.
Which is how we end up with courts saying things like, the EPA interpretation is unreasonable, even when the EPA's experts spent years studying the science and the court spent maybe an afternoon with briefs.
We can think about it as Chevron and Chabelle. She's trusting the expert who actually examined the problem. And Skidmore is Skye, deciding based on what seems persuasive. And that means that the non-expert's answer could just sound better, regardless of its veracity.
And relying on the wrong one can cause headaches in medicine and in administrative law.
Wasn't that such a good setup?
That was nice. Okay, so where does Skidmore come from?
1944, this is Skidmore v. Swift & Company.
What happened in the case?
We had 7 employees. They're at a meatpacking plant in Texas, in Fort Worth. And they're required to stay on the company premises waiting for fires to break out.
Wait, they're just waiting for the fires to break out?
Yes, they're just auxiliary firemen at this meatpacking plant. They have to be on site in case of an emergency, but while they're there waiting, they can sleep, they can play cards, they can eat, they can leave briefly if they're just running a local errand, as long as they're ready to respond if an alarm goes off.
That sounds like a pretty good gig.
Maybe, but the question was, is this time where they're just stuck there waiting, is this work under the Fair Labor Standards Act? Because if it is, they're owed overtime pay.
And the statute didn't define that.
No, the Fair Labor Standards Act required overtime pay for work over 40 hours a week. But is sleeping in the firehouse work if you are contractually required to do it? Is eating dinner while you're on call work? Is playing in checkers while you're waiting for the alarm work?
I could see arguments both ways. They're not actively doing anything, but they're also not free to leave.
Yeah, and that's what makes this case significant. The Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, that was the agency officially in charge of the FLSA, had developed extensive guidelines on exactly this kind of situation. They'd issued bulletins, they'd issued opinion letters, interpretive guides, all trying to work out when waiting time counted as working time.
The agency had thought about this and created a set of rules around what it means to work.
Yeah, they'd thought about it extensively. But the crucial detail here is that they didn't have any formal rulemaking authority. Congress hadn't given them the power to issue binding regulations defining work. All they could do was offer these different types of guidances and interpretations.
So their opinion was just an opinion.
That is what the company argued. And the court could have agreed. They don't have the rulemaking authority. We don't need to give them any deference. But instead, here's what the court said.
So they said, we consider that the rulings, interpretations, and opinions of the administrator under this act, while not controlling upon the courts by reason of their authority, do constitute a body of experience and informed judgment to which courts and litigants may properly resort for guidance. The weight of such a judgment in a particular case will depend upon the thoroughness evident in its consideration, the validity of its reasoning, its consistency with earlier and later pronouncements, and all those factors which give it power to persuade if lacking power to control.
So power to persuade if lacking power to control. That's the heart of Skidmore. The agency couldn't force courts to accept its interpretation because, again, they had no formal rulemaking authority. But if the reasoning was good, courts should still listen. Here's the part that people miss. Skidmore wasn't significant because it created this new big deference test. It mattered because the relevant agency didn't have rulemaking authority. They couldn't issue binding regulations. All they could do was publish these interpretive guidances and memos.
So courts weren't asking, should we defer to expert regulations? They were asking, should we defer to what an agency has to say, even when Congress didn't give the agency rulemaking power?
Yes, that's why Skidmore says agency interpretations get respect only to the extent they're persuasive. They don't have the force of law behind them, but, and this is the key point, like we talked about last episode, courts have long been extremely deferential to agencies when they did have rulemaking authority. Skidmore was the exception, not the rule, at that time. To try and explain this, we're going to look at Yakus v. United States. This was decided just a few months before Skidmore. This is a case about wartime price controls, which had been granted an incredibly broad delegation of authority. And the Supreme Court basically said, when Congress gives an agency the power to make binding rules, courts are not to micromanage that. Here's what they said.
It's no objection that the determination of facts and the inferences to be drawn from them in the light of the statutory standards and declaration of policy call for the exercise of judgment and for the formulation of subsidiary administrative policy within the prescribed statutory framework.
If we translate that, they're saying, yeah, agencies are going to have to use judgment, and that's fine. That's their job. We don't need Congress to tell the agency exactly what to do. Then they go further.
Acting within its constitutional power to fix prices, it is for Congress to say whether the data on the basis of which prices are to be fixed are to be confined within a narrow or broad range. In either case, the only concern of courts is to ascertain whether the will of Congress has been obeyed.
So this is incredibly deferential. The court is saying it doesn't matter whether Congress was specific or vague. They could have absolutely been clearer. This was giving this agency the authority to determine what prices should be. Congress could have just said prices should be exactly what they were on this date. They didn't do that. They gave the agency authority to determine what date they would be using for the prices. And that meant that the role of the courts was to just check whether the agency had stayed within the lane Congress drew. And then we come to a line that really kind of crystallizes the constitutional philosophy of the era.
So they said, as we have said, the Constitution has never been regarded as denying to Congress the necessary resources of flexibility and practicality to perform its function. Hence, it is relevant that Congress might itself have prescribed the maximum prices or provided a more rigid standard. Congress is not confined to that method of executing its policy, which involves the least possible delegation of discretion to administrative officers.
This helps show why Skidmore looks so modest in comparison. At this time, courts were operating in a world where broad delegation and agency rulemaking authority meant strong judicial deference. Skidmore's respect proportional to persuasiveness wasn't the baseline. It was what courts did when agencies didn't have actual legal rulemaking power. Meanwhile, in cases like this, the court was saying, if Congress gave you rulemaking power, we're going to defer unless you're wildly off course. This is the contrast that the modern court tends to blur and why it's so important to understand Skidmore properly. It is worth noting that this was a wartime powers issue, so we're going to be particularly deferential to the executive then, but this was also a criminal case. So they could have very easily said it needed to be clearer than it was.
So Skidmore wasn't for everything. Then what affects the weight courts give to agency interpretations?
Under Skidmore, we're looking at the thoroughness of the consideration. Did the agency think really hard about this, or is this just some quick opinion they dashed off before lunch?
Okay, like whether my doctor actually examined someone or just took a brief look and dashed off a prescription.
Yes, like the thorough examination the doctor was giving in the hypo at the beginning here. The next one is the validity of the reasoning. Does the interpretation make sense? Is there a logical connection between the statutory text and the conclusion?
So not just the agency saying, trust us, we're the experts, but actually showing its math.
Exactly. And next, consistency with earlier and later pronouncements. Has the agency been saying the same thing over and over again? Or has their position shifted depending on who's asking?
I thought that with Chevron, agencies could change.
Yes, and we'll get back to that. So next is this catch-all, all those factors which give it power to persuade if lacking power to control. That's things like, is this the area of the agency's core expertise? How long have they been interpreting the statute? Have they consulted with different parties? Is there evidence Congress was aware of their interpretation and endorsed it?
So when you add all this up, what makes an interpretation highly persuasive versus not persuasive at all?
Highly persuasive is a longstanding, consistent position from the agency. An agency that administers this exact statute that has been developing through careful study over years with detailed analyses explaining how it connects to the statutory text and purposes, which I'll point out is what the court was functionally saying the agency did in Skidmore.
That sounds like it would get almost as much respect as a binding regulation.
And they often did. But we can contrast this with something that would get low persuasiveness, or a litigation position that the agency was only presenting after it had been sued, contradicting what they'd said earlier, some sort of agency document with minimal analysis, something that was outside their main expertise.
And that basically gets no weight.
Yeah, courts are really skeptical of these ad hoc rationalizations. if you didn't think about the reasoning until you got sued, it's hard to claim it's your considered expert judgment.
So it's genuinely a spectrum, not a yes or no question.
Yeah, and that makes Skidmore flexible and unpredictable. Judges have real discretion in weighing these factors.
Okay, so let's go back to Chevron for a second. Remind me the difference between Chevron and Skidmore.
Chevron was this binary test. Step one, is the statute clear? If yes, that's the answer. If no, we go to step two. Is the agency's interpretation reasonable? If it is, the agency wins, period. The court doesn't weigh factors. It doesn't consider persuasiveness. As long as it's reasonable, the agency interpretation controls.
So Chevron was an on-off switch, and Skidmore was a dimmer.
Yes, and agencies loved Chevron because it was predictable. If you went through notice and comment rulemaking and your interpretation was reasonable, assuming the statute was ambiguous, you won. You didn't need to worry about whether a particular judge would find your reasoning persuasive enough.
Okay, so then what happened to Skidmore?
For a while, scholars were starting to think that Chevron was really all there was, and Skidmore was basically irrelevant.
I'm sensing that that has changed.
It certainly has now, but it first changed in 2001 when the Supreme Court decided a case that functionally resurrected Skidmore.
What happened in 2001?
United States v. Meade. Meade imported day planners, like spiral notebooks for scheduling appointments, and U.S. Customs had to classify those for tariff purposes. Were these going to count as bound diaries, which had a 4% tariff, or were these other notebooks, which had a 0% tariff?
The fate of empires rests on whether a day planner is a diary.
The legal issues here were crucial. The Customs Service issued thousands of these tariff classification rulings, and they were claiming that every single one of them deserved Chevron deference.
Did they get it?
No. And this is where Meade became really important. The Supreme Court said Chevron deference only applies when Congress has delegated authority to the agency to make rules with the force of law.
So what does that mean?
Generally, they're saying we're only going to give Chevron deference for notice and comment rulemaking, or formal rulemaking, if they wanted to do that. We'll have to deal with formal rulemaking in another episode, or formal adjudication. That's also going to come up in another episode. But these are elaborate processes, like what we talked about in the notice and comment rulemaking episode. Customs ruling letters, in contrast, these are issued by field offices. There's thousands of them every year. There's no public comment, no elaborate process.
So no Chevron for basic ruling letters by agencies.
Yes. And here's the crucial part. The court didn't say those letters get no deference. Here's what the court wrote.
There's room at least to raise a Skidmore claim here, where the regulatory scheme is highly detailed and customs can bring the benefit of specialized experience to bear on this case's questions. The classification ruling may be at least a respect proportional to its power to persuade, and may claim the merit of its writer's thoroughness, logic, and expertness, its fit with prior interpretations, and any other sources of weight.
So Meade said that Skidmore was absolutely not dead, and now it suddenly applied to a huge category of agency actions.
Like what?
Like the exact stuff we've been talking about in Skidmore. Opinion letters, policy statements, guidance documents, agency manuals, interpretive rules, enforcement policies. All of the different informal ways that agencies communicate their understanding of the law.
That's mostly what agencies do.
Yes, it is. Notice and comment rulemaking is really slow and expensive. Agencies do far more non-formal ways of letting the public know what they think. And after Meade, all of these other methods are getting Skidmore deference.
Okay, so then after Meade, we had two deference regimes running parallel to each other.
Yeah, here's the hierarchy we had in place. The very top level is Chevron deference. This applies to notice and comment regulations, formal adjudications, things coming from a very high level of the agency that were legally binding. Agencies' reasonable interpretation controls in these situations. Then at the middle level, we have Skidmore deference. And this was opinion letters, guidance documents, policy statements. In these cases, the agency interpretation got weight based on its persuasiveness. And then the bottom tier, there was absolutely no deference to a position the agency had developed for the first time in litigation or other arbitrary actions the agency took.
Okay, so let's get back to some real-world examples.
Okay, the EEOC issues a guidance letter talking about when certain conduct constitutes workplace harassment. It's a guidance letter, so that gets Skidmore, not Chevron. The IRS issues a revenue ruling interpreting the tax code. That gets Skidmore, not Chevron. The Department of Labor sends an opinion letter about overtime rules. That gets Skidmore. The FDA issues a warning letter about drug labeling. That gets Skidmore.
But if the EPA goes through full notice and comment to issue a new regulation about emissions,
then that gets Chevron.
This has created an interesting strategic choice for agencies.
It did. Do you want the maximum deference courts give? Great. Go through the elaborate notice and comment process. Do you prefer flexibility and speed? Then go ahead and issue guidance documents, but accept that courts are really going to scrutinize your reasoning.
So the process itself was a signal about how much deference you'd get.
Yes, and this created really useful incentives. Agencies couldn't just issue informal guidance and demand that courts blindly defer to them. If the agency wanted strong deference, they had to do the work to earn it. It also meant that agencies that were issuing huge numbers of documents could choose how much time they wanted to spend on each one of those documents, since the explanation that would matter when we're reviewing Skidmore is the explanation the agency gave at the time, not an explanation it came up with in court later when its actions were challenged.
Okay. I'm hearing a lot of past tense in this description.
Yeah. As we mentioned in the last episode, Chevron is dead. Next episode, we're going to be talking about Loper Bright, the case that actually kills Chevron. We'll talk about what the Supreme Court said, why they decided to overturn 40 years of Chevron precedent, and the implications for the administrative state going forward.
Because all of this constitutes a seismic shift for the way administrative law has operated.
Yes, this is huge. Losing Chevron would have been bad if this had been the defining feature of the last four decades. But hopefully, what's been shown over this episode and the last one is that Chevron itself was just a codification of what courts had been doing for decades, since before the APA was even adopted. And now that it's gone, we are in uncharted territory.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.